From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Margo Adler, filling in for Terry Gross. Many of us are wondering what's going on with the weather, with one of the warmest winters on record and recent extremes in temperature. On today's Fresh Air, we take a look at the research into climate change with Paul Mayevsky. He headed the Greenland Ice Sheet Project, which drilled holes in the ice 2 miles deep to chart climate change back 100,000 years. He's also the author of a new book, The Ice Chronicles. Also, imagine an asteroid hitting the Earth. Writer Sherry Tepper does. She's author of over a dozen science fiction novels. Her latest is The Visitor. We'll talk with her. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. American Roman Catholic leaders say priests who become notorious for sexually abusing minors will be defrocked, but a new plan church leaders announced at the Vatican today stops short of a zero-tolerance policy to dismiss all abusive priests. Catholic clerics ended a two-day meeting with a statement that offered only a general outline on the church's response to the sex with minors scandal. Cardinals told reporters the church would dismiss first-time offenders if they represented a future threat, but left open the door to keep on priests who would not abuse again. Israel dispatched a top-level diplomat to meet UN Secretary General Kofi Annan in New York. They'll discuss Israeli concerns about the fact-finding mission into its assault into the Jenin refugee camp. Palestinians have called it a massacre. NPR's Anne Gerrels reports from Jerusalem.
Ambassador Alan Baker, legal advisor to Israel's foreign ministry, complained Israel had not been consulted in the selection of the UN team. Baker also complained Secretary General Kofi Annan suddenly exceeded the mandate of the Security Council. Specifically, Baker said Annan spoke of findings and conclusions which anticipate a judgment, not merely a compilation of fact. Far from having something to hide, as Palestinians charge, Baker said Israel is anxious to present its case. He said no more than 80 Palestinians were killed in the Jenin operation, mainly gunmen. But given Israel's problematic history at the UN, he said Israel wants to make sure it's not being set up. Anne Gerrels, NPR News, Jerusalem.
Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld is headed to Texas. He'll be one of the administration officials preparing for Crown Prince Abdullah, who visits President Bush tomorrow at his Texas ranch. NPR's Tom Gelton reports.
President Bush's meeting with Crown Prince Abdullah will focus partly on how much support the United States can expect from Arab countries for the ongoing war on terrorism. A U.S. military operation against Iraq, for example, would require some Arab cooperation. An indication of how much the Pentagon has at stake in the Bush-Abdullah meeting is the fact that Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld will help prepare for it. After his visit in Texas, Rumsfeld leaves on a trip to Afghanistan and neighboring states. Pentagon spokeswoman Victoria Clark says Rumsfeld will focus there, too, on relations with allies.
A big part of the strength of this effort thus far has been working with our coalition partners. Circumstances change, conditions change, and he just wants to constantly be managing those relationships.
Rumsfeld is expected to visit other Central Asian states, though his itinerary has not been announced. Tom Gelton, NPR News, Washington.
The State Department today alerted Americans abroad that there is a possible terrorist strike, perhaps in the Persian Gulf or Arabian Peninsula. The department's statement said Americans should be careful that unprotected targets may be selected by terrorists because security at U.S. installations has been strengthened. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 58 points. The Nasdaq was off 16. You're listening to NPR News. A Massachusetts man has been found guilty in the shooting deaths of 7 co-workers. The man went on a shooting rampage at a suburban Boston software company in December of 2000. Tony Randolph of member station WBUR reports.
After 16 hours of deliberation over the past 3 days, the jury rejected 43-year-old Michael McDermott's insanity defense. The software engineer testified that he had heard voices and seen hallucinations for years, but kept that hidden from his doctors. When he took the stand in his own defense, he told the jury that he stepped through a portal in time back to 1940 and killed Adolf Hitler and other Nazis, not 7 co-workers. But the prosecutor said McDermott planned the murders after the company, Edgewater Technology, told him of plans to garnish his wages, to pay more than $5,000 in back taxes and fines. As the verdict was read, family members of the victims held hands and cried. McDermott had no reaction to the verdict. He faces an automatic life sentence with no chance of parole. For NPR News, I'm Tony Randolph in Boston.
The House today passed the first financial reform bill to emerge from the Enron collapse. The measure calls for a new oversight body for corporate accountants and quicker disclosure of insider stock sales. The bill passed overwhelmingly, despite objections by some Democrats that it was a Republican attempt to paper over the corporate scandal. Investigators in Placentia, California, say a freight train ran a red light moments before slamming into a commuter train yesterday in Southern California. Two people were killed, about 260 others were injured. The head of the National Transportation Safety Board said there's no question the Burlington Northern train should have stopped, but she stopped short of blaming human error. I'm Frank Stacio in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from IDI, innovative developer of distribution and warehouse facilities coast to coast, on the web at IDI.com. IDI, we get things done.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Margo Adler, sitting in for Terry Gross. Everybody always talks about the weather, and we all think we know what's going on. And usually we think something strange is going on. At least that's what you hear on the street, in buses, and in coffee shops. Here in the Northeast, for example, we had record days in the high 90s last week in the middle of April. And everyone tells you storms are more intense. Does any of this anecdotal stuff have any facts behind it? Paul Majewski is co-director of the Institute for Quaternary and Climate Studies at the University of Maine and co-author of a new book, The Ice Chronicles. In the last 10 years, the secret history of climate has begun to be unraveled. Scientists have been drilling into Greenland ice 2 miles down and slowly pulling up ice cores, each about a meter long. These cores reveal secrets about the history of our climate going back more than 100,000 years. You describe Antarctica and the ice core projects as time machines. When did scientists begin to understand that looking at an ice core could give you information?
The first ice cores that were drilled in Greenland and Antarctica in the late 60s and early 70s. People were mostly interested in trying to find out the engineering properties of the ice. But by the middle 70s and late 70s, it became apparent that there were things that were trapped in the ice, obviously that had come from the atmosphere, and that they were trapped in their correct order, the oldest ones near the bottom, the youngest ones near the top. And by the early 80s and mid-80s, many of the fields of analytical chemistry were able to allow us to detect very, very low levels of chemicals. And that's exactly what we have in these ice cores. So suddenly there was a match between the analytical chemistry, the fact that we had these remarkable trapped records, and a growing awareness and interest in the environment, largely revolving around things like acid rain and the beginning of the growth of, or the identification of the growth of greenhouse gases.
When I looked at your book, The Ice Chronicles, I couldn't picture an ice core. I'm not a very visual person. That's probably why I'm in radio, but I want to know what it looks like. How big is it? You know, how would you actually describe it? I couldn't get a picture.
Ice cores are in some ways silly-looking things. They're anywhere from about 2 inches to 5 inches in diameter. We tend to pull them out as roughly 3 or 4 foot long plugs of ice, and once we pull one out, we drill back down into the other. They look like white cylinders. Sometimes we'll see something quite remarkable in them, maybe some volcanic ash, but normally they just are white. And if you look at them more carefully through reflected light, you can see that there are differences in the shading from one portion of the ice core to another, and those are related to the difference between winter and summer snow, which allows one to actually count back year by year.
So they're sort of like layers in a tree. They're sort of like
exactly.
Tree rings.
It's like a giant tree ring.
And so there are these tubes of ice, and you take them out. They're, what, about a meter long, a yard long when you take them out?
In some cases, they're several meters long, but more typically, they're about a meter long when we pull them out. And certainly when we transport them, they're only a meter long.
And can you see these layers with your eyes, these different strata?
You can see the layers with your eyes if you look carefully, and you can actually count from year to year. And when we first did that, we were pretty shocked that we were able to go back a few hundred years and realize that we needed to really calibrate this. So we found other techniques, several other techniques for being sure that we could actually count the years. And then something quite remarkable happened. We kept on counting years and counting years, and eventually got down to 110,000 years of very, very well-dated ice core record.
Now, how far did you have to go down to get to 110,000 years?
We drilled down about 2,700 meters to get to that age, and then a total of about 3,000 meters, a little bit over 10,000 feet, to get to the very bottom of the Greenland ice sheet.
So you're talking about 2 miles down?
Yep, 2 miles down, and it took us two or three summers of reconnaissance, followed by 5 summers of working about 4 months every year to recover that record.
Now, before you had this ability, how far back could you go in studying climate?
Before we had the ice core from Greenland that has really changed our view of climate, there were records that went back much farther, hundreds of thousands of years, from the deep ocean. But they didn't tend to be as detailed as the record we have from Greenland and now from Antarctica, these annually resolved, subannually resolved records. So we had an understanding of how long-term climate change operated, but we didn't have detailed enough records to understand how quickly climate could change.
My guest is Paul Majewski. He's co-director of the Institute for Quaternary and Climate Studies at the University of Maine. Along with Frank White, he's the author of The Ice Chronicles. So what do we now know about climate change that we didn't know before this whole process that you've been involved in for 10 years took place?
Prior to recovering and understanding this record, we didn't necessarily believe that natural climate variability could operate very fast or very frequently. We now know that it can be very, very dramatic. There can be 20 degrees centigrade changes in temperature occurring in less than 10 years, with dramatic changes in storm patterns and precipitation. And that system could be set up for several hundred years and then go away in 10 years. We know that the most dramatic of those events occurred when the Northern Hemisphere had a lot of ice cover on it. The next thing we found out was that even during times similar to today, when there isn't that much ice cover in the Northern Hemisphere, you can still have dramatic changes in climate. They may not be 20 degrees centigrade. They may very well be only 1 to 4 degrees centigrade. Also changes in storm patterns. And to verify that these are, although smaller, still very important to humans, we've done a tremendous amount of work with archaeologists and have found tremendous correlations between dramatic changes or even collapses in society and the changes in climate that we see in our record. So although more subdued in the last 10 or 11,000 years, natural climate variability is still a big player. We've learned that the climate is controlled by many different things, and we've actually been able to unravel these so-called climate forcing factors, and many of them are predictable. They operate on order of hundreds and thousands of years, but there's a natural rhythm to climate, which has never really been as well understood before. We've also learned that it is absolutely undeniable that humans have had a dramatic impact on the environment. Levels of greenhouse gases are higher than they have been in hundreds of thousands, if not millions of years. Levels of acids in the atmosphere are higher than they have been in thousands of years. Of toxic metals, of organic acids, of radioactive products. And the ice core records really give us that time perspective that shows us that the change of the last 100 years to the quality of the atmosphere, both physically and chemically, has been very, very dramatic. And those things are undeniable.
When you talk about rapid change, and what do they call it? Rickies was the name for it in your book?
That's what we call them in our book, rapid climate change events.
Rickies. And here we're talking about what? It could be 10, 20 years? How rapid is rapid?
Rapid for some of the very big events that we talk about is occurring in less than 10 years and sometimes less than 2 years. And these are changes. The very biggest, of course, were more than 11,000 years ago, but humans were around then. And that means that in the space of a couple to 10 years, people could have been plunged from a winter that was only 2 or 3 months long to a winter that was 12 months long that lasted for several hundred years. And obviously would have had a pretty dramatic effect on their oral tradition.
Now, most of us sitting around and listening to you speaking are thinking in much shorter periods of time. I mean, we're thinking about the last couple of weeks, and the last couple of weeks on the East Coast have been bizarre. We had 96 degrees in Manhattan in, you know, the second week of April, then suddenly a cooling period. And, you know, that's not the kind of rapid change you're talking about, or is it?
No, it's really not. It would be, our rapid climate changes would be the equivalent of having many, many days in a year in which the temperatures were much, much hotter or much, much colder or much, much stormier. At the end of our year, we may very well average out to something that looks pretty much like last year. That doesn't mean it makes it easy to live from day to day, but our records are really helping to tell us where we've come from in terms of climate history and allow us to determine much better over the next few years what we should probably expect in terms of drought and storms and temperature.
We've been in a relatively warm period, haven't we, for the last 8,000 years?
Yes, actually we've been in a relatively warm period for maybe 11,500 years. And the last century has certainly been dramatically warm compared to that time, although there have been in the past 10,000-11,000 years, periods that are even warmer than today.
And according to what you write, we should be entering a new glacial period, according to the cycles that you've been looking at?
Yeah, it depends on the amount of time that you want to project over. Without a doubt, in the next several thousand to tens of thousands of years, we will see a dramatic cooling in the climate and a regrowth of the ice sheets. However, looking at the next over the next couple of hundred years, I do believe that in terms of the natural climate system, we are still within one of the potentially cooler and more stormy periods of the relatively mild last 10 or 11,000 years. But clearly, if you look at the temperature records, that's not the case. If you look at the records of atmospheric circulation, it is the case. And it's from that point of view that I think our evidence helps to demonstrate that something different has happened in the last 100 years. We have actually superseded what probably should be a cooler climate with a warmer climate and superimposed it on a naturally very stormy climate.
Now, one of the things that you mention, or at least I read in several articles, is that you can actually think about how climate change has affected past civilizations. And two of the civilizations that you mention are the Mayan and the Vikings. How so?
Well, one of the great products of this ice core record has been possibility to talk to people in many different professions, solar physicists and archaeologists, historians. And we've done a lot of work with archaeologists and have with them identified those times in the last few thousand years during the growth of civilization when there seem to have been the largest changes. And we find very strong correlations between several of those time periods and very unique events in our climate record. Periods that we can interpret as being very dramatic drought, very dramatic cooling. And I think it's almost undeniable that, particularly for societies that were founded around cities that couldn't move nomadically away from a region, they had to have been affected by these changes, particularly if they lived right on the edge of, for example, a desert or right on the edge of the sea ice where small temperature, or in the former case, precipitation changes could make a big difference.
So if, for example, the Vikings couldn't move out to sea because it got cooler and there was a larger ice sheet, they would be affected?
Absolutely. And it would only take, in the case of the Vikings, a very small drop in temperature, a degree centigrade, for the sea ice that surrounded Greenland, which had been their home for several hundred years, to be completely locked off from Europe. And the interesting thing about the Vikings who went to Greenland was that they went there in about AD 1000, when the climate was warmer than the than AD 1400 when they disappeared. And they were resupplied regularly, literally yearly, with materials from Europe, and they didn't adapt to the Eskimo culture. So as a consequence, when the supply ships couldn't get through anymore, they had a long tradition of not adapting the way the local people had. They weren't nomadic, so they disappeared.
My guest is Paul Majewski, the author of The Ice Chronicles. We'll talk more with him after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Paul Majewski. He's co-director of the Institute for Quaternary and Climate Studies. Along with Frank White, he is the author of The Ice Chronicles. One of the things that fascinated me is that the ice cores, besides revealing climate changes, have also been able to pinpoint certain historical events. The two that fascinated me was that they revealed evidence of the meteor that landed in Siberia. And the other thing that I couldn't get over was that they pinpointed the date for the volcanic eruption of the Minoan city on Thera. Is that correct?
Absolutely. That's why this records are such a delight, because they provide a framework for a whole gamut of unbelievably interesting environmental situations, the exact timing of volcanic eruptions, because we can count year by year down to the eruption, the effects of the Tunguska meteorite impact, the tremendous forest fire burning that accompanied that is seen really clearly in our records. In addition, we can find events like the Dust Bowl of the mid-1930s and realize that we've got to go back another 250 years in North American environmental history before we see anything like the 1930s Dust Bowl again.
And how do you, I mean, how does that event show up in the ice core? I mean, how can you pinpoint it?
We have many different measurements that we make. We can look at the gases that were trapped in the atmosphere at the time. We can look at the dissolved chemistry, the particles, and these are particles that are wind-blown particles and volcanic particles, and by putting all of them together, we can reconstruct the circulation patterns of the air, and it's really a matter of finding anomalous or unique signatures in one of these particular variables. In the case, for example, of ammonium, big spikes in ammonium are produced by forest fire burning, and we know that because there are also other chemicals that go along with that ammonium that exactly label forest fires. Big spikes in sulfate come from sulfur gases that were emitted during big volcanic eruptions. We do a lot of calibration to know that those interpretations are correct.
Are there other historical events that have been noted that people would find fascinating?
There's the Tambora volcanic eruption of 1815-1816, which produced in eastern North America and western Europe the year without a summer. That's a fascinating event. If we've taken a look, for example, at the time period of the sinking of the Spanish Armada and found out that for 20 years before and 20 years after, that turned out to be a very stormy period. However, if they had gone more than 20 years before or more than 20 years after, it was generally a less stormy period, and They may not have been sunk at sea on their way to attack Britain.
Wow. Now, often we read contradictory reports. We hear that Antarctica is warming, Antarctica is cooling, the ice is growing thicker, the ice is growing thinner. Now, it's a big continent. Are both happening? What should we see when we see these reports? What should we be thinking?
You're absolutely right. It's a big continent. It's 1.5 times the size of the United States, and portions that are very far north are without a doubt experiencing warming. There is collapse of the floating ice areas around them. The low-lying portions of so-called West Antarctica, close to South America, is receiving more accumulation because there's warm air around the coast, and that warmer than has been in the past, so it brings more precipitation in. And there are portions of East Antarctica which, at least for the last 20 years, have been cooling, and some of that could very well have to do with the where the air comes from that comes into East Antarctica. Much of that air may come from the high atmosphere, the stratosphere, where in fact cooling does occur when warming occurs in the troposphere. So it's a big place, and I think a lot of perhaps the thing that is most important is the fact that we are seeing along the coastline in the most northern areas some very dramatic recession of glaciers and break off of large masses of ice that, at least in the last few decades, is very rare, and from many of the ice core records we believe is rare over at least hundreds if not thousands of years.
Paul Majewski is co-director of the Institute for Quaternary and Climate Studies at the University of Maine. Majewski's book, The Ice Chronicles, details his research. We'll talk more with Paul Majewski in the second half of the show. I'm Margo Adler, and this is Fresh Air.
The north winds blow, it's 12 below. Streets like ice, ain't it nice to be snowbound, snowbound, no place to go, hip deep in snow. We're all right, tucked in tight, 'cause we're snowbound, yes, we're snowbound. The bad news is the weatherman says more bad weather, snowbound. That here we are socked in together. The corn has popped, the clock has stopped. What a storm, what a sight. We'll keep warm through the night, 'cause we're snowbound, snowbound.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. Also by Dial Press, a division of Random House, publisher of Franklin Flyer, a novel set during the 30s and 40s by Nicholas Christopher, author of A Trip to the Stars. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the global warming debate. We continue our discussion with climate researcher Paul Majewski. His new book is The Ice Chronicles. Also, science fiction writer Sherry Tepper on why she's interested in apocalyptic themes. She's written over a dozen books. Her latest is The Visitor.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Margo Adler, back with my guest Paul Majewski, the author of The Ice Chronicles. Majewski spent years heading the Greenland Ice Sheet Project, analyzing ice cores deep within the Earth. Majewski says the research reveals a history of dramatic climate change, much of it natural, some of it man-made. How do you view the global warming debate currently, and do you find that your own work intersects with that debate?
I definitely feel that the work that we've done from the Greenland program and from other ice coring activities has added valuable information to the debate about global warming. We can find evidence in many of our records for the fact that the last 100 years have experienced increases in temperature that are greater than the increases of the last 600 to 700 years. We can demonstrate that natural climate probably would not have been warming. And we can provide perspective going back much farther. So I think our records, unlike the instrumental records, they may not be as densely spread around the planet, but they are in some pretty important spots in the polar regions and in some of the high-altitude mountain regions of Asia, and work by others in South America, all demonstrate that over the last 100 years, we're seeing something unique in terms of warming compared to the previous 100 years. Exactly how much of that change is produced by human activity, of course, one could debate a little bit more, but when you look at all of the things that humans have done to the atmosphere, increase in greenhouse gases, et cetera, changes to the ozone hole, one is forced into the correlation that we have an awful lot of strange human additions to the climate in the last few decades, and we have some strange physical changes happening to the climate, and without a doubt, some very strange changes in the chemistry of the atmosphere. You put all that together, and I think it points very strongly. We won't know perhaps the final answer until 30 or 40 years from now, when we can actually look back and see that change. But I think there's enough evidence in all of these other environmental indicators to point to the fact that the less we can do to complicate the climate, the better, and the more we can do to clean up air quality and stabilize climate, the better off we are.
What do you want to leave people with? I mean, if you had one message besides the absolute glory of scientific adventure, what would you want to leave them with?
I think perhaps for the most important message is the fact that it'd have to be two messages, that natural climate variability can be very, very large. It will always continue into the future. And then an equally important message, and that is that without a doubt, humans have changed the chemistry of the atmosphere beyond anything in the natural environment. And there is the highest probability that we have had an effect on temperatures, at least in the close to the surface of the Earth. And we have become a major component of change in both the physical and the chemical component of the atmosphere.
When you say that humans have caused all of these changes, are you're generally talking about changes that are negative? Pollution, pollution. I guess greenhouse gases, or are we talking about a mix of things?
Much of the change that has been produced by humans has been different than the natural environment. So if you assume the different in the natural environment is negative, that's true. The other important message, however, is that while we have been able to pollute the environment, we have also proven through the Clean Air Act and through the Montreal Protocol for protection of ozone or reduction and destruction of ozone, that we're capable of, through legislation, making some very positive changes too. So I'd say The important message is that we are able to both positively and negatively affect the environment.
But signing a piece of paper doesn't always make change, does it?
No. For some things, it certainly has been successful. For others, it's more complicated. I think we, in the Ice Chronicles, we talk about what we think is sort of a logical plan for the future that ideally takes into account the fact that we need energy. People need to travel to work, drive cars, and what might be a smart way to look at the environment. I think there has to be a constant evaluation on both sides, but the important thing is not just to have the discussion, but is to begin the action to make these changes, because many of these changes don't have to in any way be economically impractical. Under the right situations, new sources of energy, new ways of recycling can all be economically very viable and create whole new industries.
So suppose that human beings continue in their ways and don't make these changes. What do you see as the future?
If we don't change, I think that if we don't change what we're doing, we will obviously see increased levels of greenhouse gases and acids and toxic materials in the atmosphere. We will see increases in temperature. As a consequence of that, we will see declines in air quality, declines in water quality. I think we have to think very seriously. We in fact, have to make some changes. Now, how you make those changes, of course, is something else. They've got to be done in a way that that protects developing countries, that protects people. And I think those are things that can be done, but they can only be done through open dialogue, through cooperation on an international basis, and by beginning the actual process. We would obviously we plan on continuing our research and finding out more ways to understand and make better predictions of climate, but that does not mean that we should wait until we have the final answer before changes are enacted. The changes are required now.
One of the things that you talk about is the connection between the science that you're doing and space science. Mm-hmm. And, of course, when we think about the fruits of all those Apollo NASA missions, we see the Earth seen from space. You see that, you know, the connection of seeing that one globe, seeing how fragile the Earth is, et cetera, that blue sphere in that huge space. What other connection are you talking about when you say that there is a connection between space science and these ice cores?
Well, space science, and in particular that those early views of the Earth from outer space, not only showed us that the Earth is a relatively small place, but really how it's connected. At the it's not that people didn't understand this before, but the visual picture is always very important. How one portion of the atmosphere is connected to another, to the ocean, to the land, how the color changes. And it gives you the big picture in a spatial sense. Ice cores or what we call the Ice Chronicles give you something that adds greatly to that picture of the Earth from outer space. And that's the view back through time. And in great environmental detail, it doesn't give you necessarily the entire picture of the Earth every single year back through time, but it gives us something that you can't see in that Earth picture. So the two really feed off each other in an immense way, and I certainly hope that the contributions from ice cores can provide, even in a small sense, the product for humanity that has come out of those first views of the Earth from outer space.
Paul Majewski's new book is called The Ice Chronicles. It details his research with the Greenland Ice Sheet Project.
I really can't stay.
Betty, it's cold outside.
I've got to go away.
Betty, it's cold out there.
This evening has been.
Been hoping that you drop in.
So very nice.
I'll hold your hand. They're just like
my
ice.
Mother will start to
beautiful.
Worry.
What's your hurry?
And Father will be pacing the
listen
floor.
To that fireplace.
So really, I better.
Beautiful, please don't hurry.
Maybe just a half.
Why don't
drink
you put
more?
Some records on while I pour?
And the neighbors might think,
Betty, it's bad out there.
Say, what's in this drink?
No cabs to be had out there.
I wish I knew how.
Your eyes are like starlight now.
To break the spell.
Take your hat, your hair looks red.
I ought to say no, no.
Mind if I'm moving closer.
At least I'm gonna say that I try.
What's the sense of hurting my pride?
I really can't stay.
Baby, don't hold out.
Ah, oh, but it's cold.
Coming up, the apocalyptic science fiction of Sherry Tepper. This is Fresh Air. Though Sherry Tepper is the author of more than 15 science fiction and fantasy novels, her writing career didn't take off until the 1980s when she was in her 50s. Tepper admits that she continually pounds on the same themes, oppression of women, environmental catastrophe, and authoritarian societies. In one novel, The Family Tree, a resurgent nature fights back. Her new book, The Visitor, takes place on Earth hundreds of years after it was hit by an asteroid. Though much of civilization has been destroyed, a small band of renegades tries to save it. Sherry Tepper and her husband live outside Santa Fe, New Mexico, where they run a guest house. She grew up in Colorado, where she first discovered science fiction.
When I was about 10 years old, I was born into a family that lived out in the country, and there were no other children around anywhere. And, of course, this was well pre-television. And so my main enjoyment when I wasn't out just wandering around was books. And I found magazines, wonderful magazines full of fantastic, weird, marvelous stories.
These are like Amazing.
Amazing, Astounding, you know, all of those that went way, way back, Weird Tales. And my father, who went into Denver to work every day, worked at an office where the bookmobile from the Denver Library stopped. And so every week he picked me up an armload of books and brought them home. And next week he took them back. And I had a lovely diet of fantasy and science fiction. So many names I can't even remember who now at this point. But it was my lifeblood. I just loved it.
Now, one of the things that I've noticed about many of your stories is they often have apocalyptic themes. But it started me thinking that there is this whole tradition of apocalyptic, dystopian, negative utopian, that is, fiction. And some of these books we know well, you know, like 1984 and Animal Farm, and there are others like We by Zamyatin, and there are all these movies we've seen like Blade Runner and Brazil. But, you know, did any of this notion of dystopia, negative utopia, hit you as you were growing up? Any of these themes?
Being out in the country, as I say, and being a reader, sometimes I ran out of things to read. And the ones that we had in our own library, the books that we had in our own library, were books that my father had as a child or as a young man. And, of course, among them were all of the child's stories out of the classics, you know, the Greek and Roman myths. and also a large print and very copiously illustrated Bible. And I read the Bible all the way through, skipping the dull parts for the stories. And I read it all the way through probably 12 or 13 times by the time I'd reached teenage. And the book of Revelations, I think, is extremely strong. And it's very strong in our heritage. Book of Revelations leads to a great deal of our post-apocalyptic thinking.
So the Bible, more than any of this history of science fiction and utopia, led you to sort of think about doing it yourself.
Yeah.
Well, I also noticed that all those apocalyptic themes that I remember reading, which were all about nuclear disaster, now they seem to have been superseded by ecological disasters. And what I notice in your work is that you often take ecological themes, ecological disaster themes, and use them. Why?
I lived in the country. I lived on a farm where there was a river and a marsh and a bosque, as they say down here in New Mexico, a woods along the edge of the river. And it was alive with birds, and it was alive with small animals. And for a lonely child, it was very much a paradise. When I left that place and then returned to it some years later, the river had been rip-rapped because it was going to flood and ruin the golf course across the other side of it where the forest had once been.
Excuse me, but what does riprap mean? I'm sorry.
That's where they line it with stones on both sides to make a channel. They dig it out and they put stones all along the side so that the river can't spread out. They often do it through cities and through towns to keep the river from spreading out. They drain the swamp for the same reason, because it's in the way. And the trees weren't there anymore, and the marsh wasn't there anymore, and the animals weren't there anymore, and the birds weren't there anymore. And I felt impoverished. I felt that somebody had taken something very valuable and very beautiful that I loved and just simply murdered it and done away with it. Now, that's just on a personal, possibly sentimental, emotional level. Multiply it by the billions and you get what's happening to the world. And I feel very strongly about it. I hope that we don't wreck the world entirely, that we don't get to the point where it's just simply too late and we can't do anything about it.
My favorite book in this category of sort of ecological science fiction that you write is The Family Tree. And why don't you give me a quick summary of it before I start sort of asking some questions about it?
You would give me that one to try to summarize.
Well, because it's impossible, yes. It's actually, and you're right, it is an absolutely impossible book. Well, maybe I'll try. We have a mystery. We have a woman cop. She's in a failed marriage. And she finds a strange weed taking over. It's almost as if nature is attacking back. And she begins investigating the death of three geneticists who are experimenting on animals. And then you're on a wild and woolly ride to 3,000 years in the future. You're into some kind of strange tribal society that you don't really understand. There are incredible twists, and without giving away the ending, I will say that a secret children's code we all lived in school figures prominently, and by the end, you have to really think about issues of what makes a human being and what is the difference between a human being and an animal. Now, is that a reasonable summary?
You did that so much better than I could have.
Well, you know, I'm interested in this book because it's humorous, for one thing. It has a lot of humor in it. And interestingly enough, when I went into Amazon.com to look at the citizen reviews of this book, and one of the things that I saw in all the write-ups of this book from citizens, ordinary people who had read it, were things like, I love this book, except the politics. Many, many times in many, many different versions. And so I have to ask you, do you think that your writing is too polemical?
It undoubtedly is. If I could just get a polemectomy.
What?
A polemectomy. Oh,
what? Yes.
I've tried. It just will come out. I don't know. It's a disease. It's something I ought to have taken out, but if I could just figure out where it was.
And how did you catch this disease?
Well, let's see. At one time in my career, I was a preacher's wife, but I don't think that took. Oh, maybe I'm by nature somebody who wants to be a school teacher.
Didactic. You want to teach. And what about working for Planned Parenthood? I heard you were a speech writer. I bet that did a lot of it, right?
Speech writer, pamphlet writer, listen to me and do what I tell you or else kind of thing. You know, you will use birth control until you're 18. Please, dear, please do this for me.
So, I don't know. Do you think it hampers writing? Do you think it gets in the way of trying to tell a story?
Sometimes I'm sure it does. I thought probably that The Family Tree was the least political book I have ever written. It had very little politics in it, very little polemic in it. It was pretty much pure story. So if they didn't like that one for the politics, gee, I don't know what you do.
Sherry Tepper's new book is called The Visitor. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is science fiction and fantasy writer Sherry Tepper. Her new book is The Visitor. She's written many novels, including Grass, The Family Tree, and Raising the Stones. Does science fiction make it easier to talk about ideas?
It makes it easier to talk about ideas with people who aren't really very interested in talking about ideas.
Well,
it sneaks up on you.
Well, some have said that it's our only real literature of ideas right now. I mean, if you think of most of the novels that people read today, most of them are about relationships over and over and over in different kinds of ways. And the thing about science fiction, it's always seemed to me, is you can remake ways of loving and learning and living and structure cities and structure society. You can focus on sort of the larger issues of our lives.
You can focus on things that are terribly important that are so overlooked day to day that no one knows how important they are. We go through our lives accepting the surroundings around us and accepting what's happening around us because it's always been that way. And we've never really thought about what's happening, what the long run is going to accomplish if we go this way. And I have a book I'm working on now called The Dogs. And in The Dogs, the idea is, what if we encounter a race whose language is not spoken at all? What if we encounter a race whose entire language is conveyed in smells? What would we have to do to talk to these people or these creatures? And it gives you a new perspective on what communication is, and it gives you a new perspective on the relationship between unlike beings. And that, of course, is one of the things that I most hate about our wiping out so much of our wildlife, is that it gives us less chance to communicate with unlike beings.
You are in your 70s. You grew up in the West. And somehow or another, you ended up as an activist with Planned Parenthood.
Yes.
That doesn't sound typical for someone who is in their 70s today. How did you get that way?
How did you get to be an activist and a feminist given your age? Let me tell you. Feminism kind of came late, but it came after the activism, quite frankly. I got into Planned Parenthood because of my concern with world population, which fits in beautifully with ecofeminism, of course, or eco-anything. And at the time that I got into Planned Parenthood, it was a very much simpler organization than it later became. And it was devoted mostly to providing birth control information and care to women who didn't know about it or couldn't find it or couldn't get it, all of which were things that I believed in very deeply. And at the time, it was a job. You know, how nice to have a job doing something you can believe in. And I got the job because I was a woman on her own with two children to support. So it all sort of fit together. I became an activist on that job because when you are confronted with the reality of the countries around the world and what they do to women, 2 books ago I took the Taliban apart. This was before our little escapade in Afghanistan, for what they were doing to women. But there's culture after culture in the world where women are treated very little better, if as well as domestic animals.
But I'm wondering how you ended up coming to these views, given your own background. Was there anything in your background, your parents, growing up, that led you to this, or was it just a sort of an aha moment?
It was a revelation. It was a series of revelations, little strokes of lightning hitting you on the top of the head. Somebody laying a hand across your back and saying, "Now listen to me," you know.
Sherry Tepper, thank you very, very much for being with us.
You're very welcome.
Sherry Tepper's new book is called The Visitor. Her other novels include The Family Tree, Beauty, and Grass. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our researcher is Jessica Chu. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Margo Adler.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and also sponsored in part by Nonesuch Records, now featuring Yankee Hotel Foxtrot, the new album by Wilco, available at Barnes & Noble Music locations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Richard Lorre about his biography of Russian scientist, dissident, and Nobel Prize winner Andrei Sakharov. Also, we meet South African writer, actress, and playwright Pamela Guillen. Her one-woman show is called The Syringa Tree. I'm Margo Adler. Join us for the next Fresh Air.